Welcome to Ask the Chief Information Officer on Federal News Radio. Every week, Federal News Radio Executive Editor Jason Miller interviews CIOs of federal agencies about the latest directives, IT challenges, and successes. Now, your host, Jason Miller.
My guest today is Frontis Wiggins, the State Department's Chief Information Officer. Frontis, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me on. I appreciate it.
So it's been a while since I've had the State Department CIO on, so it's great to catch up. There's plenty to talk about. But I'm going to actually start with, instead of looking back at old priorities, I'm going to start with our favorite topic of FITARA, the Federal IT Acquisition Reform Act. And you had got to the joy of testifying at a hearing back in December. And one of the things I found was most interesting about that testimony was you talked about the governance documents and the foundational documents that basically you've been putting in place since you got to become the State Department CIO. Roughly, it's pushing almost a year now, I guess. Talk a little bit about where you're at with that effort to really set the foundation around governance and really oversight of IT.
One of the things that really was highlighted to me is, while it's always great to go out and build new systems, that's just one piece of the puzzle. If you really are going to be a CIO for a large agency like the Department of State, you have to have those foundational pieces in place. It's like building the foundation to a house. So as came up in the testimony, there were several things that we're missing when I first came on board. Since that time, we've put together a cyber strategy framework, which has been published, a risk management framework, which has been published, and we've also done some initial work on some of the rogue IT that I mentioned testimony. So a lot of things have been put in place already and published, and we're continuing to work on several other pieces, like elements of the 100-day plan that covered governance parts as well.
Let me start with the cyber strategy. It's interesting. State Department for years and years and years have been seen as really the head of every other agency around cyber, but when you said there was a strategy that was either older or just wasn't there. What does that mean for you? And you walked in, were you a little surprised that that cyber strategy where State Department was really held out there as the head of the rest of the agencies wasn't there?
I think so, because, again, when you've got a lot of engineers out there, they like to put things in place, systems in place. But if you don't have the foundational documents behind it, it's almost putting the cart before the horse. So we had systems that are out there, but we didn't have the backing governance documents. So I was a little surprised at that. But, you know, oftentimes the needs of the moment are get something out there that's working, like continuous monitoring, and then let the paperwork catch up with it. And so I was a bit surprised, but we definitely have taken action to correct that.
Can you talk a little bit about what's in the cyber strategy, just generally speaking? Is it the processes, we will do this way, or is it more of here's what we believe in from a cybersecurity perspective?
It's a little bit of both. We based it on the NIST framework because we wanted to have a common platform that would be identifiable throughout government and private industry. So we took the NIST framework, the categories there, and then built off that to not only say here's our aspirational goals, but here are the nuts and bolts things that we're actually going to make happen. And from that, we're rolling that into a cyber action plan. So it's a little bit of both.
And that cyber action plan, talk a little bit through that a little bit as well, if you can. Those are the for the lack of a better word, the poems, right? Plans of actions and milestones. Oh, I had to pull that out of my hat.
Very good.
So is that in that general sense?
Exactly. It's the poems. It's also ANA process, ATO processes, and also roles and responsibilities of who does what to whom. Because as you're probably aware, I mean, the Department of State has got a worldwide footprint. A lot of corporate system owners, and there's definitely different opportunities for people to do different things related to cyber in that regard.
The other strategy you talked about as well that was a foundational document was also out. Remind us again what that other strategy was, and then talk a little bit about what's in that.
Are you referring to the 100-day plan or the risk management framework?
Let's start with the risk management. We'll do both, but risk management to start.
Sure. So the risk management framework, again, is something we felt that we need, because a lot of times when you're looking, whether it's a new system you want to deploy or a new service, you are always going to have opportunities, but there is also risk in most opportunities. So the idea is that we need to be a risk-based organization. We have to look at what the return on investment is going to be, what the exposure is going to be, and figure out how to either accept that risk or mitigate that risk. And so we've identified an enterprise risk officer. I won't name him here because I'm sure he doesn't want to get all those phone calls, but we've identified an individual to take that on and a risk framework to start to come up with a automated risk system so that when people want to have a service or a system, it can go through an automated process to say, yeah, and the outcome is this is a moderate risk or this is a low risk, and actually come up with mitigation strategy to address it from a systemic standpoint.
And we were just talking about IT risks right now. Yeah. So it could be cyber, but it also could be acquisition, or it could be a host of other types of risks versus enterprise risk, which is what we saw from the Office of Management Budget for all agencies to do.
Right, and that's an excellent clarification, Jason, because we do have a risk officer that sits in a different part of the organization. solution that's supposed to take a look at risk across the department. We're just talking about IT risk at this point. That's exactly right.
And what's interesting is when you talk about risk, so much of the time people don't judge the risk. And I think one of the biggest complaints that I hear from CIOs and CISOs and such is that when it comes to the auditing and auditors, IGs, GAO, is that there's always a risk-based decision. Is that the goal? Is it that person that you won't mention? We'll find him out, though, because that's our job. Is he or she will look at the system and go, okay, here's the risks, and then present you or your CISO with options and mitigation ideas?
Exactly. So it's for them to – I've always said I don't have a monopoly on either good ideas or all the brain power in this organization, which is definitely a true statement. And the idea is for that risk officer to provide me a recommendation that is a DAA. I can then say, yeah, let's go ahead and put this system into production, or no, we should hold off and have these other safeguards put in place so that I, as a DAA, the delegate approving authority, can make a decision for the enterprise from a system base with their recommendation in place.
Before this person was put in place, how was that done previously? Was it done from a mission owner's perspective or done from a CISO or CIO perspective?
Well, it was dual. So you had the CISO who would make some recommendations, but then you had system owners who were sometimes doing it in a vacuum, not necessarily in conjunction with either the CISO or the CIO's office. So this gets back to the FATARA piece. If we want to take a holistic approach to the entire enterprise for all the corporate system owners and really make the CIO somebody with a capital C that actually looks at all the different parts of the enterprise writ large. And as I said previously, that was a little bit, I won't say harum scarum, but it was not necessarily applied evenly across the board.
Now, this person's in place just recently. Are you starting to see some benefits from having a risk management person for around cyber and systems?
Absolutely. And again, it's somebody who we already had on board. We just repurposed them. So they know the processes, they know the people, they know the systems really well. And so we're just having a different dialogue with those corporate system owners. And the corporate system owners have been very appreciative of it. We've had a number of them come to us and say, in fact, it was just one person today in a meeting, said, great, we want to actually talk about this new system we want to put in place. Let me get in touch with so-and-so.
I think that's one of those positions where you saw a big rise in CDOs, right? Chief data officers. I think the enterprise risk management and this, the more specifically the system owner or the system risk management is one of those positions I could see growing. Let's move over to the 100-day plan. Talk a little bit about what that is and how many days are you into it?
The 100-day plan actually started in July, and we had to come to an agreement that based on the scope of what we wanted to do, a lot of the 100-day activities would be basically at the end of 100 days, we'd have a plan. So we had about 37 different activities. I think a dozen of them or 15 of them have been completed. The rest are in various stages of completion. Some have the plan has been put in place and now we're acting on it. So for example, the Cybersecurity Integrity Center, the KIC, we wanted to operationalize that as part of the 100-day plan. That's actually been done. We had a ribbon cutting ceremony for that. So we now have a 24/7/365 Cyber Integrity Center for the Bureau of Information Resource Management. Another one was to start looking at some of our boards and panels because of course we've got different governance boards and different tools and looking at the overlap between them and trying to winnow those down to make it a little easier for our corporate partners to work with us.
Going back to cyber again, the new center that was stood up, that's basically what people call a security operations center. You said it's for IRM, but is it really at large for the entire State Department or at least CONUS, the continental United States piece?
It's an interesting question because right now cybersecurity is bifurcated within the Department of State. You've got diplomatic security that has a piece of it, and then IRM has a piece of it. So diplomatic security has had for a little while their own Foreign Affairs Cyber Center, the FAC. So IRM didn't have its own independent operational organization to work on the IT side of the house. We had diplomatic security who had their piece, but we didn't have a commensurate piece. So the KIC is really that partnering because we have to have equal platform between the diplomatic security side of the house and the IRM side of the house. So it is for the entire enterprise, but it's IRM owned, if you will.
And hopefully they're sharing information and they're working together. I mean, that's the key, because if something's happening in the foreign world, you know, you better believe it's going to be happening in the local world.
Exactly. So that, and the importance is to have that collaboration piece. And that was the other challenge, of course. Diplomatic security would get information, and they weren't sure exactly who to pass it to. They might pass it to three or four different parts of the organization, but we decided that we need to have a single belly button, if you would, to make it easier to share that information in both directions, both when we gather operational information and when diplomatic security may gather information from DHS or somebody like that. You had to have a single point of contact for both organizations because they're very large bureaucracies.
And I can imagine that the cyber center is also going to be a place where the continuous monitoring, the CDM program, the continuous diagnostics and mitigation program, and the agency dashboards, all that's going to kind of live, so to speak.
Exactly. That's 100% correct. And it's also, as you we alluded to earlier, when we have information system security officers at 200 and some odd posts, you want to have a single shop for them to come back to, and also for a roll-up from some of those CDM tools so that there's a single dashboard for people to have visibility. So again, the idea is for IRM to manage its own household and to have a single point of contact for Homeland Security and for our folks out there in the field.
When you talk about the 100-day plan as well, what do you think has come from it that you're seeing? So July is unfortunately, I guess, for those who don't like the heat around the corner. Give me a sense of what have you seen in that year that since you started this kind of initial effort.
Two things I think at a very grassroots level was very important. In a lot of bureaucracies, you have top-down decision-making, you know, decisions made at the executive level, and everyone's told what to do. With the 100-day plan, we actually took folks at multiple levels within the organization. We went and did interviews with our customers worldwide, including ambassadors and management counselors overseas, and said, what are your pain points? What are the things that IRM can help you do? And the idea was to make a philosophical change in IRM for us to be a customer-centric organization. And so when we had the offsite to come up with a 100-day plan, it really was to get input at the entry level within the organization and the working level within the organization to inform the priorities of the Bureau writ large. And so it was to get additional buy-in. And also, as you probably can imagine, if you want people to be enthusiastic about what they do, you ask for them their own ideas. So we solicited the ideas from folks, and it's been this cultural change where we have every level of the organization now. I won't say that they're, you know, they jump up in the morning and rush off to work and say, God, I can't wait to get to the office. But at least they are part of the discussion, they're part of the solution set. And coming up with a comprehensive 100-day plan also, the important piece was to make it transparent. So we published it on our SharePoint site. People can drill into it and look exactly where we are, who's got action on any individual item, see where the status is, and see where the next set of deliverables are. And that's for both the people within IRM, but also for all our customers. And I think, again, if you want to be a successful customer service organization, your corporate partners need to know what your priorities are, what you're working on, and what the status is. And so that willingness to be transparent and open, both with our own folks, but also with our customers, was a huge cultural shift for the organization, and has paid large dividends because now people are much more willing to come to us and say, yeah, we think you're an honest broker about a lot of things.
And I think building that trust, especially when you're a new CIO, you're walking in, now you've foreign service officer, you've been in the State Department for a long time, but you're still now have that title of CIO. So creating that trust relationship probably has been part of one of the most important things you've done from a transition perspective, meaning coming into this office as a CIO.
Exactly, Jason. And one of the things that's also interesting, I think it's interesting, is that I joined with almost no IT background. When I joined in 1985, it was a world of telecommunications, and we were having a challenge in retaining personnel. Nothing against my Department of Defense colleagues. What we were seeing is people at that time need very specialized knowledge about telecommunication systems. The only folks we could get were DOD employees who were already retired. They would come do two or three tours, retire again, and so we had this high level of attrition. They made a change in 1985 to hire people with limited or no IT background or telecommunications in those days. I was one of those folks. I have a history background. I got a history degree. So I've always come at IT as a means to an end and as a tool. I don't see it as the be-all and end-all. And what I think has made me successful in my career and relates to this whole discussion about transparency and kind of the change management aspects of being a new CIO is I've always taken on the role of the customer from the very beginning because I always say, well, I always question why. I'm the doubting Thomas when it comes to IT systems. Tell me what is the business need and why I need to do something. And I've always been able to explain things in terms that people could always understand because, again, I didn't come from an engineering background or a telecom background. I learned it in situ in the department. And so when I stepped into the CIO role, it was just a continuance of that, but at a much higher level to say to folks, I understand your business processes. I'm not seduced by technology per se. I want to know how technology can help you further your goals and the objectives that you have. And so it was just a reaffirmation of something I've been doing for 30 some odd years, albeit at different levels. But it's pretty much the same message from the day I joined the Foreign Service.
All right, very interesting. Let's take a quick break. When we come back, we'll jump into some of those priorities you've been kind of alluding to. My guest is Frontis Wiggins, the State Department's Chief Information Officer. I'm your host, Jason Miller, and you're listening to Ask the CIO on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. Welcome back. You're listening to Ask the CIO on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm your host, Jason Miller. My guest is Frontis Wiggins, the State Department's Chief Information Officer. Frontis, we began the conversation really talking about the Federal IT Acquisition Reform Act, FITARA. Let me circle back to that, because also at that December hearing, one of the most interesting things you said was really is building bridges to the mission area. And you talked about two people. Governance boards, a cloud computing governance board and an IT change control board. So let's talk about that issue of how are you kind of adding more governance. And let's start with the cloud computing governance board.
It's interesting because the cloud computing governance board was formed, first meeting was back in May. And the idea behind that was we recognized that the CIO's office need to have a little bit more visibility and a little more interaction with corporate system partners. And as you said, we're a very large organization. A lot of people have diverse needs. And so the CCGB was stood up, and the idea behind it was basically two sets of members, functional members who could provide expertise in areas like cybersecurity, acquisitions, et cetera. And then you had, for lack of a better term, functional members that represent the bureau, the big bureaus like the regional bureaus, the secretary's office, and others. And the idea was that when people had a product or service that they want to have reviewed, they would come make a presentation in front of the board, the functional members could address specific areas, and then a simple majority vote to push these products out. And then to promulgate that information, we create a SharePoint site so people can say, oh, that product's already approved at whatever level. I don't need to go put that in front of the board, or I need a different product, but let me see how much of the currently approved product meets my needs. So it helps not only streamline a process and provide a process for folks to come and make the presentations, but also avoids duplication to make sure that people aren't replowing the same cow path. There you go. I mix metaphor for you. That, oh, there's already something out there that I can leverage.
How much of this board is mission versus non-mission?
That's part of this whole inventory process we're undertaking as well, because what we found is that prior to the CCGB, nature abhors a vacuum, and IT is part of nature. Folks would go out and register their own cloud instances or services through GSA or other folks, and we would find out about it after the fact. And so we also declared a cloud registration day to try and get some of those off-mission things registered and reviewed as part of the CCGB process. So we went from three or four products are being reviewed to we've got about 57 that are being reviewed currently. And the idea is to encourage folks who have off-prem or non-mission IT activities to bring them in and put them through the same governance process. In pursuit of that also, we're undertaking an entire inventory of all the dedicated internet networks out there, the DINs or the extranets or the boutique IT, the rogue IT, whatever aphorism you want to use, to get our hands around that, because all that data that is out there, if it's state data, the ultimate responsibility for that resides with the CIO's office and the Secretary of State. And we have to make sure that they're on the right kind of platforms with the right kind of security. And the only way to do that is to go out and do this massive inventory, not just domestically, but worldwide. And so the CCGB is also an effort to show that we can be a fair broker, that we want to hear from the customers, and that we want to put them through a repeatable process so it's not, oh, I'm doing somebody a favor, I'm going to approve this product for somebody because I know them, or, oh, you know, somebody else has additional cloud, I'm going to approve that for them. It's that everybody goes through the same process for mission and even, quote-unquote, non-mission, because, again, if they're using appropriate funds and there's Department of State data on it, to me, that's mission IT.
Interesting, you went from three or four registered to 57. Were you talking about just cloud instances or actual systems, or it could be platform as a service infrastructure or software?
It's the latter, Jason. It could be any of the above. It could be platform as a service. It could be an instance in an Amazon Web Service. It could be a specific product. Like, I won't name the any products, but yeah, it's kind of the whole range.
Were you surprised at 57, or were you expecting 157 or more?
Well, the other part of this I didn't mention is we found there were about 82 that are out there on GSA registered, so we still have a little ways to go. My surprise is that there were that many that actually gone through a registration process, because, again, we've got a lot of folks out there doing very important work, and a lot of times needs must. They go out and they contract for a service, and then maybe after the fact, or maybe not at all, they come back and say, yeah, we like to put this through a governance process to make sure there's no duplication or whatever. I was actually surprised by how low it was.
It seems like, going back to the early part of our conversation, it's part of that trust building that you must be going through, because you're saying, listen, I'm not going to shut you off. I mean, because technically under FITARA, you could go in there and be like, off,
right.
Tough. What you're saying is, let's bring it to us. Let's figure it out, and let's see how we can make sure it's meeting all our needs. What kind of reaction are you getting?
It's interesting, because my fear was that if I came in initially with the hard sell, people would just run and scurry off into the dark again. And taking that collaborative approach, again, as I mentioned earlier, saying, look, I get the fact that you have a business need. I'm not trying to be draconian about this or rule by diktat. I've actually found that we have a number of people coming to us willingly. In fact, I've got a couple of meetings either later this week or early next week of external system owners that now are wanting to come to us to talk to us about this because there is a level of trust that's been established. And there's a quote that's kind of related to that in that my view on this is that if you don't ask for something, you're not going to get anything. And there's, I think, Richard Bach, the guy who wrote Jonathan Livingston Seagull, said something to the effect of, argue for your limitations and surely enough you'll achieve them. I'm saying that there are really no limitations for the CIO's office in that we can be a CIO for every partner that's out there across the department and externally for those folks because we are that honest broker. And we don't want to stop people from meeting their business needs. We just want to help them get there and make sure that there is no duplication, we're not wasting taxpayers' money, and also that the data that's out there is properly secured.
In that same vein, let's talk also about the IT Change Control Board. This is probably related in the sense that someone says, well, we have this instance, now we need this plus one. Right. How do we go about that? Talk a little bit about what that board is and how it works.
Yeah, the ITCCB, the IT Configuration Control Board, Change Control Board, is more of a nuts and bolts activity where, oh, we want to put a specific piece of software out on the existing enterprise, what we call OpenNet or ClassNet. I want to put a new tool out there. And it's much more focused towards specifically the diplomatic security folks and the IRM folks, the IT folks. And it really is a different animal in that it's very stringent. It's a single dissenting vote can stop something going forward. And it's much more focused inwardly and less about the business practices. And it's more about securing the network and making sure that there are no vulnerabilities put on the network, whereas the CCGB is more about enabling business practices, where the ITCCB is really trying to limit exposure and make sure the tools and systems they're putting out there don't provide a vulnerability.
When someone comes to you and says, we want to do this, or we want to move this to the cloud, or add this new capability, does it go through, for instance, the Cloud Governance Board first and then the IT Change Control Board, or vice versa, or are they separate but equal?
They're separate and sort of equal. The CCGB can put things forward without necessarily putting them through the ITCCB unless they impact the enterprise. So if you're doing platform as a service or software as a service and external to OpenNet or ClassNet, the ITCCB doesn't really worry about it so much. However, if it's going to be a hybrid cloud approach where some of the stuff is on-prem, some of it is off-prem, then yeah, absolutely, the ITCCB could stop it.
A lot of our conversation, we focus on kind of the documentation, the governance. Let's talk just broadly, go back to FITARA. You know, State Department, it was one of the unlucky agencies that had earned a D-minus grade in the most recent grading period in December. But I know also that a lot of CIOs are less than pleased with the grading structure. But generally speaking, it's what I hear from CIOs time and again is whether or not you agree with the grades or not, it's given me the tools and the if you will, the hammer in some ways to get things done. Talk about what progress you're making to really change and implement FITARA.
You could argue that when you're a new CIO and you've got a D-minus grade, it's actually a boon because you got almost nowhere to go but up. So I look at it as a great opportunity to change how we're doing business. And I see FITARA as a tremendous tool to help that conversation with some of our corporate partners. And it's kind of interesting. I had a meeting just the other day with one of our major corporate partners, and I informed them. I said, look, I need to get more visibility into the IT spend. And they said, well, I've got this mission need, and I've got that. And if you're just checking a box, yada, yada, yada. And I said, I'm not just checking a box. It's the law. And when you say it's the law, it gets people's attention. So suddenly there is this change in attitude saying, okay, we want to partner with you. So in a way, you know, of course, we have to accept the fact that we have a D-minus. I don't really care about the grading. I'm glad that we've got an external organization that can take an evaluation of us, whether we fully agree or disagree with the grade, kind of by the wayside. What I can't agree with is there's lots of room for improvement. And so what we've done since then is really engage with those corporate partners, trying to get our hands around the mission IT. We've talked to our chief acquisition officers. We've talked to our chief finance officer. And in fact, just in the last couple of weeks, we've already identified a template for a new financial activity so that we can get visibility into the IT spend, not just the IT central fund or expedite passport fees that the CIO's office normally would, but into all the appropriate funds that are being used for IT acquisitions. The CFO is a big proponent of this. And then I just had a discussion today with our chief acquisition officer about coming up with a defined template for all the acquisitions that are out there. So it's a great starting off point. People are getting, it's getting a lot of attention. We're doing FITARA primers, and we're going to start going out and meeting with the corporate partners. We've already started doing a few, but we need to do more to really educate people on what FITARA can do for them. And a lot of them, I will say, are very appreciative of it, because some of these things have been happening in the shadows, and they want to normalize it, and they want to make sure that it gets visibility, and they get a check and a blessing from somebody. So it's a great dialogue starter, and the fact that it's a law gets people's attention, really gives me the flexibility to have those discussions with them, and then you can approach them either as a carrot or a stick. And for the most part, we found folks are very receptive to it. And in fact, we're undertaking an effort too to kind of tweak FITARA a little bit, or FITARA implementation at state. We got this idea about doing franchises, IT franchises. I got this idea from a colleague of mine, the CIO at the CIA, where they did something similar. And he told me I could say this, so it's okay. Where you look at the CIO's office as a franchise organization, just like McDonald's does, and you've got downstream franchisees that then have an agreement to say, okay, we will do the we will abide by the following rules and regulations. Here's what we expect from the franchise headquarters as a franchisee or franchise. Here's what we'll do, and we're pursuing that right now. We've got a draft franchise agreement. We're going to pitch it to somebody as an initial a template or a test bed. And again, it's a way for us to get to FITARA in a different way, as opposed to just saying it's a regulation and you have to do it.
There's several pieces to the FITARA as well I want to follow up on, but the franchise idea is fascinating, because in a place like State Department, where you're worldwide, you have tens of thousands of offices and then embassies and consulates, and they all need to have IT needs, and there's no way that you can be like, okay, well, in Japan, tell me what you're going to buy, and I'll make sure you buy it the right way. But if they're going to abide by a certain set of rules, and if you think about McDonald's as a great example, they're going to abide by the way they make the hamburger the same way. They're going to put the cheese on this way. But you can do things, maybe there's some leeway in terms of how you participate or what you do. So give me a sense. I mean, you want to pilot this, it sounds like, and just see how it works. And then if it works, make adjustments and then expand it.
Yeah, the idea, it's exactly as you said, Jason. You look at McDonald's, they have certain standards that people have to abide by, but then they tweak their activity based on their local market. So you'll buy things at a McDonald's in Japan that's slightly different from what you'll buy in India. I mean, this is a perfect example. And the idea is that we're going to create a template, and we're going to pilot it with a couple of early adopters and actually have them help us adjust the franchise arrangement. And then once we have the larger corporate system owners take into account, we'll start with the biggest groups first, so we get the biggest bang for the buck, and then work our way to the smaller organizations. And the idea, again, is that we try to get collaboration on this so it works for both parties. And the other idea, which also dovetails with FITARA, is with some of the corporate system owners, they've got chief technology officers or chief IT officers, other folks buried inside their organizations. We want to try and set up a supervisory or a relationship, or maybe supervisory is the wrong term, but a relationship between those embedded elements within those bureaus and the CIO's office, and give them a title and also perhaps a reporting structure that includes interaction with the CIO's office.
Fascinating concept. I'd love to follow up with you when the time is right. Let's take a quick break. When we come back, we'll jump into some priorities. My guest is Frances Wiggins, the State Department's Chief Information Officer. I'm your host, Jason Miller, and you're listening to Ask the CIO on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. Welcome back. You're listening to Ask the CIO on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm your host, Jason Miller. My guest is Frances Wiggins, the State Department's Chief Information Officer. Frances, we talked a lot in the first two segments of the show about FITARA implementation, governance. Let's jump into some of the technology side, your priorities. What are you hoping to get done over the next 6 or 9 months?
I want to see us move to more of a cloud environment. We've kind of dipped our toes in the water when it comes to cloud. I mentioned earlier we had 50-some-odd instances, but from our enterprise view, we haven't really moved a lot of our enterprise applications, like the Office Productivity Suite, out into the cloud. I want to get us pushed out to Office 365, to be honest with you, Azure. I also want to get out there and really push Wi-Fi. Right now, we have some Wi-Fi pilots overseas and domestically. I would like to get ubiquitous Wi-Fi around the world. One of the ideas is to get away from wired workstations. I spent a lot of time and money on doing cabling worldwide. And as you said, when you got 280 locations, some odd, you know, you go from UTP 5 or Cat 5 to Cat 6, and now we got fiber. If we can get people to a tablet-based environment where they're a lot more mobile, also with a secure environment, that's where I want to be. I also want to get more true two-factor authentication on all our different platforms and use a unique and consolidated ID management system, IDMS for the enterprise. So use a single identity with a single PIF card that gets you to your cloud instance, gets you to your mobile environment, that gets you to, if you still have a desktop environment, gets you to that. So big priorities are on mobile, Wi-Fi, and cloud. Also, I'm sitting right now on the Innovation Council or Innovation Subgroup of the Federal CIO Council. I'd like to see some stuff around AI and machine learning. I'd like to see some activity where we're getting away from human-to-human interaction, see if we can put the machine in there a little bit. I mentioned earlier I wasn't seduced by technology, but I do see some instances where, you know, a smart machine or a learning machine could be there to do some of the things that we would normally have a person do. Gets us to an interesting question about how do you actually fund that stuff. And I'm hoping that we get to an IT modernization fund through the Federal CIO Office or Congress so that we can actually do some upfront capitalization, some innovation activities.
All right, so a lot to unpack there. Let me start with the cloud. One of the things with cloud tags us back to FITARA and data center consolidation. I think the State Department has been maybe ahead of the game a little bit on data center consolidation. Give me a sense of where the cloud and data center fits in and over this big FITARA umbrella.
I'm going to laugh because according to our FITARA score, we're not ahead of the curve when it comes to data center consolidation. But thanks for bringing that up. Yeah, they are progressing. Well, I'm being a little facetious, but it's interesting because after my testimony, David Pounder came up to me, and he's of GAO, and he said, look, we really want to work with you to help you address the FITARA challenges. And separately, our OMB folks came to us and said, we need to understand state's environment a bit better. And one of the challenges is how you define a data center. And right now we've got, according to our FITARA score, 300-some-odd data centers. A lot of those include what I would call equipment rooms or equipment closets overseas. To me, we have maybe a dozen real data centers worldwide, and a lot of the rest are what I would call equipment rooms. But GAO and OMB have been really terrific about this to say, look, we want to better understand your environment and give you an appropriate grade. So we're working with our OMB examiners in particular to take them out to some of our overseas locations that we view as real data centers, and then to take in some of the more downstream places, if you will, some of those quixotic, exotic locations that they might say, you know, maybe we shouldn't count this as a data center. One of the other things we're trying to do to, as far as our cloud implementation, one of the limitations is the trusted internet connection, which DHS mandates for federal agencies. We've been talking to OMB and we've been talking to DHS about trying to get an overseas tick because the performance on some of the cloud products are problematic when you have to backhaul all that data. You get somebody sitting in Canberra who wants to look at a website in Sydney on the outside and somebody from the mission in Canberra, that session goes all the way from Canberra, all the way back through our tick domestically, then the session goes all the way back out to Sydney, the response goes all, I mean, it's just this round-the-world circuit of data. And so we've been talking to DHS and OMB to try and get an overseas tick implemented and also to perhaps establish some consolidated overseas data centers and collapse some of those equipment rooms into specific locations, not only to improve the return on investment, but also improve the security, because you've got 260, 200 locations. Why not consolidate some of those into regional locations where you can put the proper structure and monitoring and also allow better performance?
That's a fascinating concept, an overseas tick. When obviously, it's another kind of something to follow up with you on as it gets moving. And they've also talked a lot about cloud and the tick and how those two things work together. Let me go down the path of cloud as well. Right now, State Department has a consolidated email, but it's not in the cloud. And your goal is to move that into the cloud, but also some of the productivity tools into the cloud. So that's where Office 365 comes in.
Exactly. And the big lift there is I can put Word for 365 and SharePoint for 365 out there, but that corporate email, which tends to be not only our tool du jour, but also our knowledge management tool du jour, which is kind of a horrible concept. You know, if you're using email as your knowledge management tool, it's a real challenge. That's the big lift. I want to get us to an enterprise cloud email solution. I can get the other productivity suite tools done pretty quickly. In fact, we're anticipating doing it this fiscal year. The email is going to be the last piece because it's the hardest lift. And because we have a very specialized tool. You may have heard of it. It's State Messaging Archival Retrieval Toolkit. SMART is built in Outlook. It rides on Exchange infrastructure that we have at just about every post. So making that transition of the email platform is going to be very difficult. But yeah, it also improves your mobility, obviously, if you put your corporate email system into the cloud. That's where I want to get to. I think email will be the last piece in the puzzle. The rest, we're already piloting. We have about 1,000 folks using it. And let me tell you, the biggest issue is not technological, I'd have to say. It's cultural. An example is I was sharing a document and collaborating on a document with one of my office managers who's sitting in a different annex. And as he's typing stuff, I was typing stuff over the top of him. And he picked up the phone, and all he said to me was, "This is scary." So the cultural change aspect is huge. It's not the technology necessarily.
It's interesting that you're saying email is most difficult. You know, a lot of agencies, as they jumped into the cloud, email was first, and that's considered the low-hanging fruit. Explain maybe just a little bit more about why email is more difficult for state than maybe some other agencies. You mentioned SMART, the retrieval system. Is that the main reason?
It's partially that, Jason, but it's also the survivability, sustainability of email. Without going into too much detail, if you put all your email in the cloud and you're sitting in Belgrade, for example, and you lose that link back to corporate headquarters because of the tick, if you had a cloud-based email system, you couldn't even email somebody down the hall from you. So for continuity of operations, we have Exchange servers in just about every location. So even if you lose that connection back to the other post, you can still email people in the same building. And a lot of the other federal agencies don't have that worldwide footprint. And so that's the real challenge, is when you want to collapse all that into a sustainable environment, I've got to make sure that I've got multiple routes to get to every location. And honestly, if I've got to backhaul all that traffic, that's where the risk is.
The other priority you mentioned that I want to drill down a little bit is the two-factor authentication, the single sign-on. Now, we know that agencies have made a great progress in implementing the HSPD-12 and the PIV cards, the smart identity cards. You seem to be saying that plus.
Right. Exactly. So we met the OMB mandate last December to get two-factor authentication in the hands of all our non-privileged users or lower-privileged users. We're right now about 90% of the way for all our privileged user accounts. But the idea, again, is that it's not just to get access to the enterprise system, which is what we've done. It's to have a single or a series of identities on a single card that gets you to your cloud, your mobile environment. Right now we have a little bit of a, I won't say a hodgepodge, but different ways to do that authentication. And I want to get us to a single authenticated enterprise solution that does all those different platforms. So yeah, it's exactly that. It's enterprise plus.
One of the other priorities I want to bring up is mobility. What we've seen over the years is the move away from BlackBerry to iPhones, to Android phones, tablets. Where is State Department in that? Is mobility, because of the email situation, the cloud, are you guys a little behind on the mobility factor? Or where do you sit in terms of trying to get, you know, State Department, Foreign Service officers, and other employees access to the tools they need?
We're a little bit behind. We've got a lot of folks who are using BlackBerry, but we have got iPhone users, iPad users. We've got some pilots right now on Surface Pros and Chromebooks. We've got a lot of different things we're trying right now. What I'd like to do is try and get that winnowed down to just a few products. We're also working on the Android platform as well. And I think that we're not where we need to be. We need to improve as far as a mobility suite. My dream, and again, you know, if people don't start laughing at you, your dreams aren't big enough, is that every in-service person who needs a mobile platform gets it when they get sworn in, either as a civil service employee or foreign service employee. If you're in service right now, you get a single product like a tablet that does everything for you, and that you have built-in two-factor authentication to all that. Large form factor like a tablet, you can do two-factor right now. Our challenge is really doing two-factor authentication, that small form factor with the smartphones. That's the real lift right now. So we're doing piloting on some of that, and that's a real growth area for us where we have not delivered for our customers, but I see it as a huge growth area.
Very interesting. All right, well, let's take a quick break. When we come back, we can jump into cybersecurity a little bit more deeply. My guest is Frontis Wiggins, the State Department's Chief Information Officer. I'm your host, Jason Miller, and you're listening to Ask the CIO on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. Welcome back. You're listening to Ask the CIO on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm your host, Jason Miller. My guest is Frontis Wiggins, the State Department's Chief Information Officer. Frontis, we talked a lot about priorities. Cyber came up earlier on in the conversation. Let's circle back around to cyber. Just give me an update on the iPost or continuous monitoring efforts and where you guys are at with this concept of, and include CDM a little bit as well.
You probably know that CDM, back when it had a slightly different acronym, actually started in the Department of State. So we've done some things regarding doing both reviewing stale accounts, doing patch management, centralized patch management, and also ensuring that, you know, we talked earlier about that risk framework, basing a lot of the monitoring that we're doing on risk as well. So we've got a new risk management tool that we're using to monitor activities on the network. I mentioned the KIC earlier to centralize a lot of that activity. And then also on the CDM program, working very aggressively with DHS to get that pushed out there. We have a number of appliances we're pushing out there. One of the challenges, as you mentioned, in the environment that we're in is how deep do you go on that continuous monitoring? Do you go down to a work-level switch at a post overseas, or do you have it rolled up to a regional location? And so we're talking to DHS about that to make sure that when we do put CDM out, and we've already started to pilot it, that it really does give us a granular level for us to be effective in keeping our system safe.
One of the other pieces of cybersecurity is obviously the CISO-CIO relationship. Talk a little bit about what State Department's looking at. And I've talked to your former CISO years ago. And again, these efforts all require everyone to work together.
We've got a new CISO, as you mentioned, it's Al Bowden. But in addition to that, we also create a managing director position within our Information Assurance Directorate to make sure that we're getting the bang for the buck when it comes to ATOs and ANA process. We're also partnering very closely with Diplomatic Security to make sure that our CISO is well positioned to work with our corporate partners and also to inform and make recommendations, risk-based recommendations, to the CIO as a whole.
Because one of the things that whenever you talk about the CISO and the CIO and that relationship, it's got to be a partnership. We know that. Is that something that's been fairly smooth for you so far?
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the things I've always believed in is that I don't have a monopoly on good answers. I need people to be independent thinkers and make independent recommendations. So I've empowered the CISO to really be that independent arm to give me the real warts and all vision of what the challenges are and what the risks are. And then as a DAA, I can either accept or not accept those recommendations. But I really want our CISO to be independent to make those recommendations without being influenced by my own personal perspective.
Let's move on to another topic, innovative diplomacy and innovation. You mentioned that as some of the cutting-edge technologies like AI and machine learning. First of all, what is innovative diplomacy, and then how does that fit into the larger digital transformation?
First off, innovation is not modernization. I think a lot of people get that confused. You can use this quote. I've used it in a couple other instances that modernization in a lot of ways is paving the cow path. You take something, you just automate it, or you put a faster processor or whatever. That's not innovation to me. Innovation is changing the way you do business and how you deliver services. And the way to get there is by engagement with the customers, because I expect my customers to know their business processes better than anybody else. So one of the things we're doing in regards to innovation is standing up a customer engagement office. I call it a customer requirements office. But the idea is that if we want to be innovative, we have to engage and tease out from folks where they're the pain points in their business processes and how we can help them. Because a lot of time customers come to you with a solution in search of requirements, and we have to go about it from a different perspective. We have to gather requirements and determine what the solutions should be. When I talk about innovation, it's really helping to understand the fundamental changes that can take place within the organization and how IT can help.
A ton of stuff is going on. I think there's plenty to follow up with you in, so we'll have you back on the show sooner than later. In the meantime, thank you very much for taking the time. My guest has been Frontis Wiggins, the State Department's Chief Information Officer. Frontis, thank you.
Thank you, Jason. I look forward to talking to you again in the future.
You've been listening to Ask the Chief Information Officer. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show on our website, Ask the CIO, Thursday mornings at 10:30, only on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM.